Iowa is among the highest in per capita gun ownership in the United States. We are also among the lowest in gun violence. And that's because we are one of 19 states that have background checks right now required on all handgun purchases.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. That clip you heard was of Amber Gustafson, an Ankeny woman who serves as the president of the Iowa chapter of Moms Demand Action on Gun Sense in America. She will be telling us about an omnibus gun bill that has been put forth in the Iowa House and why her group considers much of it bad sense. But first, we have the story of a mother of another breed. If there's anything more American than guns, it's eagles. And America's favorite eagle mom has laid her eggs. Here's Local Talk wildlife correspondent Pat Schlarbaum with the scoop on the Decora eagles.
Well, let's have an update from the Raptor Resource Project director, John Howe, who oversees the Decora eagle nesting pair, the famous Decora eagles. Welcome to Local Talk.
Thanks, Pat.
How many years has the Decora eagle pair been established there at the fish hatchery in Decora?
With this pair, this male eagle, I believe the 10th year now that we've had this pair, and with about three eggs each year, that's about 30 eagle eggs produced by this pair.
Yeah, it's not every eagle pair that would have three. I think two is much more standard, but your pair seems to be quite productive. Well, where are we at for this year?
Kind of an interesting year, I think. Interesting one because of the weather and just the weather temperature swings and things like that. But with the nest, we had our first egg on Monday about 7:30 in the evening. And, you know, we usually have about a three-day period here in between eggs, and that was right pretty much just about on time. We had just last night on the 23rd here, then second egg at 6:20. So we could be expecting a third egg possibly in about a little less than 3 days now.
So first part of the last week of February, and is this relatively early for bald eagle nesting?
Actually, this is pretty much right on time with what we've been experiencing. Last year, she laid her first egg on the 18th of February. So with it being on the 20th this year, you know, a couple days a little bit later, probably the thing that was a little bit more interesting is at the Eagle Cam and Nest north of Decora, our other nest.
Oh, the second nest with the camera?
That nest was about 3 weeks later delayed compared to the fish hatchery eagles that we're talking about, the famous ones that we've been watching for so many years. Mm-hmm. And this year, they actually laid an egg almost 2 days before this pair. So there was a big shift in the time period where that north nest pair of eagles laid eggs compared to the fish hatchery Decora eagles.
And tis a season, I guess you would say.
Right.
There are as many as 400 nesting pairs of bald eagles in Iowa. So this is the time of year that our resident bald eagles are initiating nesting. So I might point out that there are 400 nesting pairs of bald eagles in Iowa. And these are the resident eagles. But we still have a few of the migrants that are here visiting. It's kind of interesting that they're aware of the fact that their northern areas are still frozen, and of course they rely on fish primarily this time of year.
Right.
So we still got some visitors visiting bald eagles, and now with the resident ones, they seem to be initiating nesting at an early time of winter when people would not anticipate that. And you do a lot of work with your cameras. I know after Bob Anderson's the previous director and kind of got the Raptor Resource Project going, his untimely passing, that you stepped in a big way, and you've been very involved with the technology of bringing these Decora eagles to the world. Could you tell us a little bit about your cameras and equipment?
Certainly. So what we have at the fish hatchery now, and this is pretty much standard at the other nests, and that goes with bald eagles, it goes with the peregrine falcon cam at Great Spirit Bluff, and some of the others that we have with partners like Excel and Darylin Power. What we've done is moved over to a platform where we've got what's called an IP camera, Internet Protocol. So in the past, it was an older technology, analog technology. So big difference there is if you think of your old TV screen, you had what was about 480 to 500 lines, TV lines per inch of the screen. And now we're up to lower grade HD, which is 720 lines per inch, or in the case of the cameras that we've got, 1080p, so 1080 lines per inch on that screen. So that, what does that give you? Gives you a much higher definition, higher quality picture, which really makes it look more like you're right there.
Yeah, I think you've been offering the state-of-the-art technology of these nesting birds. And do you have any work with your microphones?
Yeah, you know, that's probably one of the biggest challenges is the sound part of it. We've had some issues with microphones going in and out and, you know, working and not working, but definitely the audio component of this has been changed to newer technology also. And in, for the most part, the sound quality is much better. As far as reliability, you know, I've got backup. We've got backup there. We've designed redundancy in there, so you know, if one microphone fails, we've got audio from another source that we can rely on. So again, improved audio quality. I think we've got some pretty good vocals coming out. Actually, I remember when Mom was laying her first egg, Mom Decora, on the 20th. You could hear these really faint little chirps, and we typically hear that as she's going through the egg passing laying process. So some good audio. I'm one of those perfectionists that it's like I'm not quite satisfied with things, so I have a plan to make it even better for next year already.
Oh, fantastic. We'll sure have that to look forward to. Let's see, is there anything else? Have you detected any of the young in the egg communicating with the parents?
I think my own personal experience, I've heard much more of that, you know, right close to a day or two prior to the first pip or poking through with the egg tooth for the eagles, it would be. But for peregrine falcons, I've heard quite a bit of activity where we've got the microphone right up in the nest box. You can hear that activity going on, and you can see that the female will get up off the eggs and look down, and you can tell that something's going on there, right? There's some communication going on there. See that same kind of activity with the eagles where she'll get up and or dad, the male will get up, and they almost know what something's going on there. They can feel probably some of the minor vibrations, and they can probably hear some of what's going on. So that is definitely something that happens. We've heard some of that, and we see that behavior in the way the eagles act right before hatch start.
And hatch will be, if everything goes as planned, around April 1st. Is there anything else that comes to mind you'd like to share with our listeners this morning?
I think just thing that is a huge benefit for one of our primary missions, and that is outreach and education. It's such a neat thing to be involved where we can pass this video through to classrooms, and we've got the classroom moderated chat with our moderators who do such a great job, and the videographers who take video clips and make them available. And that's such a big part of our mission that is one, to get people engaged, and two, we have so many people that are engaged in their electronic devices that Once you get that engagement and are connected, get outdoors and go take a look for yourself. I think that's the best thing that we can tell people right now.
Yeah, get outdoors and enjoy this fascinating nesting pair of bald eagles and all in life. Thank you so much. John Howe.
Thank you, Pat.
With the Raptor Resource Project centered near Decorah, Iowa. And let's keep our fingers crossed for another successful hatching of these eggs of the Decorah nesting eagle pair.
Certainly.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Pat.
And you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Thanks to Pat Schlarbaum for that wildlife report. These last 2 months have been an interesting ride in Iowa for folks keeping their eye on legislation. And this Friday is the deadline known as the funnel. A bill must pass out of committee in at least one chamber by this Friday if it is to be pursued as Iowa law this session. Among the laws racing toward the finish line in this heat is an omnibus gun bill. To provide us a description of what all this bill contains, I drove to Ankeny to visit with the president of the Iowa chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense, Amber Gustafson.
We have an omnibus bill that has about 12 different, smaller portions inside of it that deal with a lot of different things, including permitless carry, a piece of legislation known as preemption, which overrides county and municipality ability to set their own gun laws. There's Stand Your Ground, which is very famous because it's connected with the Trayvon Martin case out of Florida. There's also an under 14 portion to allowing children under the age of 14 to handle handguns. That's also part of the bill. You know, then there are some other pieces that are probably a little bit less controversial, but those are some of the ones that are the most visible and the ones that are the most concerning to a lot of people in Iowa.
And as of now, these are all rolled into one omnibus bill.
It's coming out of the House right now. And yes, it is all in one bill. And I know that there are a lot of Iowans and a lot of lawmakers who have raised concerns about the fact that, you know, because these things are all rolled into one bill, it makes it really hard for legislators to, you know, work on a bill like this because it's kind of an all or nothing, take it or leave it type of thing. And I know there are parts of the bill that have been voted on in the past that have had bipartisan support. And so I know that there are Democrats that want to support aspects of the bill and that do support Second Amendment rights in Iowa. And so, it's just a matter of getting all the players to come to the table and to talk about what can we do to really make things safe for everyone in Iowa.
When you say permitless carry, what are you speaking of?
So right now in Iowa, we have a dual permitting method. So you can get a permit to acquire, which allows you to be able to go out and purchase a handgun and then keep it in your home. Or you can get a permit to carry, which allows you to be able to go out and buy a gun, a handgun specifically, for the purposes of carrying it in public. In Iowa, you can either conceal or open carry, whatever type of weapon you have a permit for. Or what the bill talks about is making changes to the permit system, which would make permits an optional thing. So in other words, if you wanted to purchase a handgun and you went to a federal firearms dealer, like your Cabela's or Bass Pro or Walmart or your locally owned gun store, you would still go through a background check because that's required by federal law. However, the problem that we have with the bill in Iowa is that if you wanted to purchase something privately from your friend or your neighbor or a relative, there would be no background check and no permit required. The bill would kind of place penalty for someone who, knowingly sold a weapon to someone that they know to be ineligible to own or possess a weapon. But, you know, I do have concerns in the sense that if someone is trying to sell a several hundred or even several thousand dollar item, they may not be too motivated to find reasons to disqualify the buyer. So it places a lot of onus and responsibility on a person who is, you know, who could be motivated by financial gain. So I think that we need to do better when it comes to the issue of permitting in Iowa, or, you know, at the very least, we need to keep the permitting system that we have because it's working right now. You know, Iowa is among the highest in per capita gun ownership in the United States. We are also among the lowest in gun violence. And that's because we are one of 19 states in the United States that have background checks right now required on all handgun purchases. So what this bill would effectively do is remove the required background checks on private sales and open up a whole other market for unregulated sales.
You mentioned also the permitting for carry. Is that going to be affected at all by this law?
Yes, it absolutely would, because, theoretically a person could, a prohibited purchaser could purchase a weapon privately and carry that in public without, without any type of a permit or a background check. And this sort of thing has happened in Missouri. And, we've already seen, what the impact of that has been in Missouri. Aside from an increase in gun violence in a state that already had issues with gun violence, we've seen police departments and sheriff's departments that have seen a significant loss in revenue because permits cost money. And that's money coming into the police department. That's money coming into the sheriff's department, which is now gone. Another really important part of the permitting process is education. When you go through a permit class, it's not just learning about how to safely handle your firearm. That's an important part of it. But the other aspect that's really important is teaching gun owners and people who plan to carry in public what their rights and what their responsibilities are under the law. And so in a state like Missouri, where permits are now optional, people are not following through. They are not getting permits. And that is leading to people that are carrying weapons in public without being aware, without fully understanding the implications of the law. So there was just an incident that happened a couple of weeks ago in Columbia, Missouri, where a man had put his cell phone up for sale on Craigslist, and he met in a public place with a guy to, sell him the phone. When he handed over the phone, the guy that was buying the phone took off running with it without paying for it. And so the guy who was selling the phone drew his weapon, and he shot the guy in the back. And when the police came and they arrested him, he said, I have a permit. And they're like, well, you don't have a permit to shoot someone who's running away in the back, and you can't shoot someone over property. But that's where the problem comes in, is that people don't understand what the limits of their rights are. And so we get situations like this. Now, thankfully, in that situation, the individual, and yes, he was a thief, but, stealing is not a capital offense even in Missouri. But, thankfully he actually survived and, hopefully will go on to, make better choices in the future and be fine. But it could have been a much more disastrous situation.
Okay, so you are saying that the permit for carrying a weapon under this omnibus bill would now be optional. To carry a weapon would require no kind of education and no kind of government involvement, really.
Specifically on private sales. So, again, if you're going to purchase a gun from a federally licensed firearm dealer, like your Cabela's, your Walmart, or your local gun shop, you're still going to go through the federal Brady background check. But if you purchase it privately from your friend, your neighbor, or someone that you met online, then it's optional.
Both to own and to carry.
Correct.
Now, stand your ground, those are ominous words. Remind us what exactly the stand your ground legislation means.
Well, stand your ground obviously is a little bit different in every state. Right now in Iowa, we have this law in the books known as Castle Doctrine, which means that, basically, first of all, your home is your castle. You can absolutely do anything within the four walls of your home to defend yourself and to defend your family. You do not have to, modulate your response to a perceived threat within your home. You have the full right to protect yourself and your family. My understanding is that was extended recently to include your yard or the area surrounding your home. In public in Iowa, the words that really seem to have an issue, or the people have a real issue with, is this duty to retreat. And basically what that means is that if you are in a situation where you feel threatened, if you can get away safely and without harming yourself or someone else, then you need to do that. You need to try to do that before you take action, fatal action, to try to protect yourself. what this law could potentially do is to say that you no longer have that duty to retreat, that you do not need to look for an exit strategy for yourself, that at the moment that you feel threatened, you can use lethal force to protect yourself. And that's outside of your home. That's in public places. That's bars and restaurants and shopping centers and gas stations and, you know, different places like that. And the other part of the bill that is questionable for a lot of people is the fact that there is a provision in there that says that if you are in a court of law and it's found that you were not threatened, but you sincerely believed you were, you can still be acquitted. And so, you know, again, it becomes really, really problematic because at what point can we say, that this person, you know, really committed a crime. It becomes really legally very muddy. You know, and the other thing that I think my issue with this bill would be is that I don't see this as something that is a huge legal issue in Iowa. Again, we have very, very low gun violence in Iowa. So armed confrontations like this are extremely rare. And so this is kind of a legal remedy for a problem that I'm not really sure where the evidence is for it.
Okay, and we've heard certainly anecdotal evidence of the effect of this stand your ground type legislation mm-hmm. with the Trayvon Martin case, as you mentioned, where a young black man wearing a hoodie was perceived as a threat mm-hmm. doing his daily errand mm-hmm. and shot and killed. Are there broader-based statistics describing the effects of stand your ground legislation?
I don't have those right off of the top of my head, but I do know that, places where stand your ground is legal, it does have a definite impact on communities of color, in general. And I know that it does also impact the numbers of justifiable homicides. And, so it definitely increases the number of people who die via gun violence. So, it's definitely something we want the legislature to take their time to really consider, to think about all of the unintended consequences that could come about as a result of this. And I think, you know, there's a certain amount of mindset. The average person is not a legal scholar and they don't fully understand the implication of all of their rights and responsibilities. And so, use another example from Florida, there was a young man by the name of Jordan Davis, an African-American boy, 17 years old. He was in the back of an SUV. They stopped to get gas. He and his friends were having a good time. They're playing music. They're horsing around, kind of being obnoxious and that sort of thing. And an older gentleman who happened to be white, who was a concealed weapons permit holder, was at the pump next to them and was offended by their music, didn't care for it, didn't care for their behavior, made a few comments to him. Possibly they were a little bit flippant back to him, probably not as respectful as we would wish all of our teenagers would be. And he perceived that as a threat, and he proceeded to pull a gun out of his glove box and to fire shots into the vehicle as it was leaving the premises, and he shot and killed Jordan Davis. And it was just unbelievably tragic, and he attempted to use the stand your ground defense as well. And in Florida, with a jury of his peers, he was found guilty, and they rejected the stand your ground argument because Jordan Davis and his friends were not armed and the vehicle was fleeing. But that was in his mind at the time that he pulled that gun, that he felt threatened and felt that there was some sort of a legal basis for him to take that action. And unlike a lot of other things, there are no do-overs with this kind of law.
Yes, you make a very strong point that it is not just what's legal and what's not. It's really about the effect on a culture of this kind of legislation mm-hmm. And your concerns about the Iowa culture, which right now seems to be pretty safe.
Right.
I asked Amber about her organization, Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Motherhood is not typically a role that carries a lot of political clout, but when it comes to guns, no group has been as effective in making their case for common sense regulation.
So our organization started after Sandy Hook, and a lot of people kind of refer to Sandy Hook as the 9/11 for American moms. And in a lot of ways it was, because that was the day when we realized that gun violence wasn't out there. It was right here. And in addition to that, like so many others, when I saw what happened at Sandy Hook, I was definitely devastated. But as I began to do research and I began to understand more, I realized that 91 people every day were being shot and killed in this country. That's more than three Sandy Hooks every single day. And the vast majority of them are suicides. And so what I love so much about our organization is that we actually look at peer-reviewed research that shows what action can actually prevent the most deaths, whether it's suicide or law enforcement deaths or intimate partner violence or, you know, any of those types of things. And, you know, what we have come to understand is that the single best thing that we can do to prevent gun violence is background checks. Background checks work. They've kept over 3 million guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them since 1992. The Supreme Court has held up background checks as perfectly legal. My husband and I actually are gun owners ourselves. We went through a background check when we purchased our weapon, and it took all of about 2 minutes. It's not an inconvenience. It's not an infringement. And I think it's really a small thing to ask of responsible gun owners in order to keep their community safe. It's kind of along the same lines as flying on an airplane, you know, which is in terms of inconvenience, far more of a hassle to take your shoes and your belt and your coat and, you know, all of that kind of stuff off. We kind of have a social contract that says, hey, in order for us to all be safe, we all submit to, to this vetting. And I think that that's a reasonable thing to ask Americans to do, and certainly Iowans.
Say a little bit more about that process. You say it took only 2 minutes. Was that to fill out a form, and then did you have to wait a while they looked your name up?
So the way the NICS background check system works is you do fill out a form that has some information. You hand that to the seller, and they input your information into a secure system that's solely for the NICS background check system. They can call. I believe there may be an online option now, but they can call, and they get a response that says, yes, proceed, no, do not proceed, or wait. And so there's no information given to the individual who is processing your request to purchase a weapon. So in other words, if you're declined for whatever reason, it doesn't say no because of et cetera, et cetera. If it comes back as a wait, the seller then has 36 hours to resolve that hold. In other words, they have to try to find additional information to either proceed with the sale or to deny the sale. If they cannot find information within 36 hours, it's a default proceed. And so in the case of the shooter that killed 9 people at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina, he actually was an ineligible purchaser. But yet, because the information that would have disqualified him from being able to purchase was not fully submitted to the NICS background check system, he received a 36-hour hold. And then it was a default proceed, and he went back and purchased his gun. So, you know, it's a very tragic loophole, and that's something that can be really, really dangerous. And, you know, that's something that we need to look at on the federal level.
But instead, here at the state level, we're looking at taking away that entire level
right.
when it comes to private gun sales.
Right, exactly. Private handgun sales, not having to go through a background check or making it optional, it just opens us up for things that are much more dangerous. And, one statistic that I really like to make sure to share with people, because I have a lot of very dear friends who are law enforcement officers and I care very deeply about keeping them safe, is that in states that do not have background checks on all handgun sales, 53% more law enforcement officers are killed every year. I think at the end of the day, for us, what we really firmly believe is that every person in Iowa and every person in the legislature has the same goal, which is to keep their own family safe and to keep their community safe. We have some different ideas about how to go about it. And so the most important thing we can do is sit down at the table and talk about how can we respect your rights and how can, you know, we respect public safety and make those things come together to create not only a place where Iowans are very, very safe, but also a place where they're very free to express themselves, you know, their Second Amendment rights as they would like to. So we have a really strong history in Iowa of being able to do that. And I think we're an example to the rest of the United States of how you can have a good, strong, healthy gun culture of self-defense and hunting and sports shooting and all of those sorts of things, and collecting while still keeping people really, really safe by having good gun laws in place.
Okay, well, A final word about you personally. You mentioned, you know, getting involved after Sandy Hook, mm-hmm. doing research and so forth. Can you say a little bit more about why this issue has spoken so deeply to you?
Absolutely. Well, I guess I come at it from two different perspectives. The first perspective is that I grew up on a farm in southwest Iowa. We had guns in our home. I learned to shoot at a young age. I like to kind of joke that the first date I ever went on, there was a gun in the car, which most people are like, oh my word. But there was. There was a gun in the gun rack on, you know, and nobody thought a thing of it because that was just part of the culture of where we lived, and gun responsibility was something that was just woven through the culture of where we lived. Guns were viewed as tools, not as toys. Or not as something to, you know, express your manhood or your womanhood or whatever you want to say. So it was a very different mindset when it came to the issue of guns. When I moved to a more suburban area and I began to see the toll of gun violence in my own city, you know, just what I would amount to senseless killings, I began to realize that there was a disconnect between. But kind of between the two worlds that I kind of had my feet in. One world that is a very confrontational type of violence, and another world where people used guns for the most part very responsibly. And so I thought, how can these things come together? How can we web these things together? This gun responsibility and this respect for freedom with this need for public safety and protection. And, you know, coming out of Sandy Hook, the building itself looked so much like the building where my kids were the day that that happened. And I had a first grader, just like there were first graders that were shot and killed that day. But what really motivated me the most was the fact that the conversation around the shooter began to change. And instead of it being just disturbed, lonely young man who had a desire for violence, the story began to become one about a young man who had ADHD, who had autism, who took medication for the management of his symptoms. And I realized that they were actually describing my son. I have a son who has ADHD, who takes medication for the management of his symptoms. And I began to realize that if I didn't speak up, that action was going to be taken to marginalize and harm people with cognitive disabilities or mental illness. And the truth is that people with mental illness are far more likely to be the victims of violence, all types of violence, than they are to perpetrate violence. And so in order to protect my son's rights and to keep him from being stigmatized in his community as a potential mass shooter, I wanted to take steps to get involved, because once I realized that it was easy access to weapons that causes so much of the gun violence that we see every day, I thought, now this seems like a problem that we can solve. If, as Americans, we can sit down at the table and talk about this. And so in my role with moms, what I've really tried to do is to bring gun owners and, you know, stakeholders in the community together to talk through these issues and, to try to see the best in one another and in one another's intentions, and to approach it with a genuineness and a vulnerability that says, again, we're all working here for the same thing. So let's set aside the fear and the rhetoric, and let's really talk about what we need in Iowa and what we don't.
Thank you so much, Amber Gustafson, the president of the Iowa chapter of Moms Demand Action on Gun Sense in America.
Thank you so much. And by
bystander.
Welcome back to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. Yesterday, on Tuesday, was the sixth Tuesday in Ames that folks concerned about the priorities of Iowa's legislature have gathered at the London Underground on Main Street, just around the corner from our station, to muster up written opposition in the form of postcards to elected representatives. I stopped in for a beer and asked co-organizer of the event, Molly Backus, what the action was all about.
So every Tuesday night for the last 6 weeks or so, we have been gathering at London to write postcards to our state senators and congresspeople, our national senators and congresspeople, and whoever else we feel like sending postcards to about all kinds of both state and national issues.
And what is the featured issue tonight?
Tonight we have some people from Moms Demand Action, which is an anti-gun legislation group. We also have some people from Access, which I don't know that much about, but they're here. And then we also are trying to pull together information about some of the bills that have been getting traction in the state Senate.
And the postcards themselves are really beautiful. One of them has a picture of the Iowa flag and our motto, "Our liberties we prize and our rights we will maintain." Who provides the postage?
London Underground has been paying for the postage and the cost of printing the postcards, but we do have donations every week too. People bring in stamps, people bring in postcards. People bring in markers, and you know it is kind of a group DIY effort. But London, the management here has been primarily paying for the cost of the postage.
And about how many postcards do you send out after a Tuesday night?
Well, every week is different. I would say the average is probably 250 to 300 postcards a week. Last week was a little slow, but most weeks we get about 300 cards.
And are these to our local legislators, or are they to anybody who's on the committee who's doing something involving the issue at hand?
It is completely up to the postcard writer who they decide that they want to communicate with. I try to, right when you walked up, I was making a list of the Senate Judiciary Committee members, because one of the bills that passed out of subcommittee today is going to the Senate Judiciary Committee, in order, you know, in the hopes of passing before the funnel on Friday. And so that seems like they would be good people to be writing to tonight if that's an issue you're concerned about. But we try to provide information for all of our, local reps, all of our state reps, and obviously you can write to the White House also if you want. We're not very prescriptive in what people, you know, we're open. Whatever your issue is, we're trying to support that. You know, we're just here to provide stamps and some information about how to get into contact with people.
Have you done a lot of this before?
No. Myself, I have not. I'm just a graduate student.
You're motivated by the circumstances.
Yeah, it was sort of a happenstance that we started this. You know, there were postcard events happening all over the country. And my friend Yana Byers, who's my co-organizer, posted, I think, something on Facebook saying that other people were doing this, and I said, we should do that. And she said, when, where, who? And I said, London, soon, everyone. and so that's pretty much what we did. We just started this, and we did it 1 week, and it's kind of grown since then. Every week I think we sort of know what we're doing a little bit better. The first week we had no idea what kind of a turnout we'd have. We ran out of postcards very early. We were using blank index cards to send postcards. We ran out of stamps. So we absolutely did not anticipate the response that we would get. But since then, we've been trying to get our machine a little bit more, I don't know, smooth every week. So we have handouts about the different, the bills that are coming up. This is information about kind of where they are right now. This shows you that, you know, these are the ones that are currently really active. And then we have addresses. We have maps of what people's districts are. We have information about different issues. We have handouts. We have markers. I don't know. We have all kinds of things. And every week we kind of have, we invite different groups to come in and chat with the people that show up. So, and our plan is to just keep doing this as long as people are hungry. I think a lot of people really want to make their voices heard or just get involved somehow, and a lot of people didn't know how to. And so this is a very easy and fun way to participate in a civic action.
What are you drinking tonight?
Coffee.
Okay, well, so nice to meet you, Molly.
Thank you. Nice to meet you. Thanks for stopping by.
Well, hi, Marilyn.
Hi, are
you here to write a postcard?
I definitely am here to write a postcard.
And to drink a beer?
And to drink a beer.
What do you plan to write a postcard about?
Gosh, where do I start? I don't know how to limit it. I think today I will write a postcard about the FBI investigation into the Russian ties.
Okay, so that will go to the federal level, and you'll be sending that to Grassley and Ernst? Or?
Grassley and Ernst, and then if I write one for the state, I'm not sure. The personhood bill, I don't know. It's hard to decide.
It sounds like you've done this before.
This is the first time I've come here to do this. I've done it at my house before.
Yeah, right. Hi, what's your name?
Hannah Frederick.
Hannah, I see you have two postcards in front of you. Who are you writing to?
So far, I am writing to our Story County Senator, Jerry Bin, I think is how you pronounce his last name, and then also our Story County Senator, Dix.
Oh, the two Republican senators from our county. What are you writing them about?
I'm writing them about the possibility of having funding cuts in fiscal year 18 budget for victim services in Iowa. Specifically, I'm writing about our local program here, Access, is an organization, and that deals with domestic violence, sexual violence, and any other victim services.
And have you heard that there will be cuts to victim services?
Yep, it's been proposed that victim services will get cuts in the next fiscal year budget, and it starts, you know, at the top state level, but then a lot of the smaller organizations get their money from the larger state organizations, and so if that gets cut, then it's just a trickle-down effect, and everyone gets cut.
Well, I'm sure you're going to have some kind of impact on them there.
I hope so.
Wow, you've written quite a lot. You're not sparing any words.
I've got a lot to say to them.
Okay, well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
And that was co-organizer Molly Backus, along with a couple of postcard writers, at the London Underground, where every Tuesday of this legislative session, folks are gathering to express themselves in writing to Iowa lawmakers. Well, we've discussed politics and guns. To cap things off, we've got a little religion for our Local Talk listeners. Father Harry T. Cook is an Episcopal priest from Michigan who will be the theologian in residence at the United Church of Christ in Ames this coming weekend. There will be three lectures on Saturday and an adult forum on Sunday. Here is Local Talk reporter Kay Puddock speaking with Harry T. Cook.
Now, when people hear the words priest and father, they tend to think of celibate priests, but you're an Episcopal priest, and I believe you're a family man, right?
I am, yes. Anglican Church has always embraced the idea of marriage, mainly because for the first 1,000 years of the Church's existence, clergy could marry, and that was ended in about the 11th century when it was discovered that the children of priests were inheriting the wealth that should have been the churches. So celibacy, not chastity, you understand, just celibacy, though we try to be chaste in a way, but
not celibate,
we are
necessarily celibate. Right.
And I have children, 4 of them.
And grandchildren, I believe, too.
I have 5 of those.
Okay. One of your lectures on Saturday will be on the figure of Jesus.
Yes.
This is a subject which you, as a scholar of early Christian texts, can be considered an expert. And I just wondered, are you suggesting that people need to revise the common understanding of the figure of Jesus?
People can do anything they want, think anything they want. I am not in that business. But I am saying that I will present what I consider to be interesting evidence that's really been staring us in the face for a very long time, that the character who is variously described in the four Gospels and the other 16 extant, to a person from Mars who came here in a spaceship, would read those and say, oh, these are different people with the same name.
Right.
And I am not sure that that's true. I have, like I think a scholar does, is try to dig up evidence and then weigh it and sort of put it out for other people to consider it. No, I'm not saying people should change anything. I'm saying here's some evidence. Try it out. See what you think.
Well, I want to sort of unravel a bit, a couple of things you said there. You mentioned the other 16 Gospels in addition to the canonical four Gospels. Could you say a bit about that?
Over time have been, through archaeology and searching and so forth, there have been other things called Gospels that have surfaced. And who knows? The Gospel of Thomas, perhaps, is the most important of that lot. We knew it was known that it existed in the 3rd century because it's quoted.
Right.
It was not literally until 1945,
right,
when I was 6 years old, that the Gospel of Thomas was found, a Coptic manuscript of it, in a cave in northwestern Egypt. I'm going to talk about that and why that's where it was found might be significant. But yes, all kinds of Gospels, and they're all very, very interesting. Pagels, who is a friend, wrote a very interesting book probably 30 years ago called The Gnostic Gospels,
mm-hmm,
and makes the point that they should not have necessarily have been subordinated to the other four, that it should be a sort of an open library for church to feast on.
Right.
But that's not how the church operates.
Now, you said someone coming from Mars would think that the figure of Jesus was different people with the same name. Can you give some examples of that?
Well, the Jesus of Mark's Gospel is an iconoclast.
Uh-huh.
Sort of roughshod over what I call the beginnings of Jesus Judaism. I coined that myself. I mean, it's a movement of people who were self-consciously Jewish, but following really the wisdom and ethical teachings of Jesus. And so he quotes Jesus as saying the Sabbath was made for human beings, not human beings for the Sabbath. Mark 2, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, we're so used to hearing that now. It doesn't cause a ruffle or a wave, but religious people, especially Christians, I think, tend to create their own limitations, and you can't do this and you can't do that. And that's not what the religion that comes out of the first century around these Jesuses and what ends up in the early documents. It was a religion of liberation and justice, soon to be quenched by the end of the first century and into the second as the church moved toward empire. But yes, the Gospel of Mark was the first, and as I will say in my lecture on Saturday, that it is pretty edgy.
Okay, and then in the afternoon, you'll be talking about salvation by works.
Well,
a humanist.
I don't know how that occurred. One of my books they're selling there is Long Live Salvation by Works, a Humanist Manifesto. My understanding is I will be dealing with several questions that have already been posed in the context of all that. And so I will hardly say a word about the book itself, other than to refer to it and make reference to James chapter to the effect that, you know, faith without works is kaput.
But I'm interested in this thing, why people are so fond of this doctrine of salvation by faith. You know, I used to teach literature. I was a college professor of literature. And there's the early English morality play, Everyman, where every man is visited by death. These are all personified figures on the stage. Death comes on and tells him he's got to go on this long journey. He's got to go down into his grave. And he tries to take his friends with him. He tries to take his drinking buddies with him. None of them will go with him. One thing goes with him, his good works. And this, again, is a personified character. The good works gets down into the grave with him. It's a little, like a little trap door opens on the stage and down they go together. Well, my students used to get up in arms about this. This was bad theology.
And the answer to that is, so what? I mean,
you know, because you're not saved by your works, you're saved by your... What is the big attraction? Is it just that they've been indoctrinated or what?
Well, it's easy. It's easy to say I'm saved by belief. But my point is that that caught on in post-colonial America, you know, like a communicable disease. Mm-hmm. And that's really what really runs the show in evangelical Christianity today. All you have to do is... You're saved if you confess belief. If you confess belief that Jesus Christ is your personal Savior, who can't do that?
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's much easier because and nobody understands, you know, the word faith in New Testament Greek. Whence we get the word, it doesn't mean, you know, airy kinds of things. I believe just because I should. It's the word trust. And as I once teaching New Testament Greek said, that what faith means in the New Testament, in pistis is the Greek word, is you're riding your horse across mountainous territory, and all of a sudden you come to this huge abyss, and you think if you get a good start, you might be able to cross to the other side, and it's a good thing too because you're enemies are pursuing you. And so you say, well, I trust myself and I trust the horse. I think I can do it.
Right, so it's like confidence.
Yeah. Either you do it or you don't. But that's what faith is. It's trust in self, trust in whatever.
Right.
You just can't dream that up. You have to have data that support that. So I have troubles with the word faith.
And to receive Father Cook's blogs, you can subscribe at harrytcook.com. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We started the show with a wildlife phenology from Pat Schlarbaum and the good news that more eaglets are on the way in Decorah, in the nest that is monitored by the famous Eagle Cam. We then heard from Amber Gustafson of Moms Demand Action on Gun Sense and from Molly Backus, co-organizer of Postcard Nights every Tuesday at London Underground. Finally, we got a taste of the theology that will be served up at the UCC this weekend by Episcopalian minister Father Harry T. Cook of Michigan. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. Thanks to webmaster Ron Carson for making that possible. Local Talk was engineered by myself. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was by Warren Zevon. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI comes from ISU Theater, presenting The Importance of Being Earnest, a trivial comedy for serious people, a satire by Oscar Wilde. February 24th through March 5th at Fisher Theater in Ames. Tickets and more information can be found at theater.iastate.edu.
Support for KHOI comes from Stevens Auditorium, presenting the award-winning National Symphony Orchestra of Ukraine. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu. Center.iastate.edu.
An innocent bystander. Somehow I got stuck between a rock and a hard place, and I'm down on my luck. Yes, I'm down on my luck. Well, I'm down on my luck. I'm hiding in Honduras. I'm a desperate man. Send lawyers, guns, and money. The shit has hit the fan. Oh, send lawyers, guns, and money. Guns and money. Send lawyers, guns and money.